Heavenly Father, thank you. Thank you for the privilege we have of coming into your presence. Thank you that you embrace us in spite of our blindness, and that in our brokenness you touch us, and our blind eyes gain sight. And I pray today that as we interact with your word, that you would enable us to see you more clearly, that we might be able to see ourselves more clearly, and then that we might be able to see the world more clearly as well. And so we commit this time to you and pray that you would shape us and open our eyes by the power of your Spirit, and in Jesus' name we come. Amen. Then you will see clearly. Measure your life by loss and not by gain. Not by the wine drunk, but by the wine poured forth. For love's strength stands in love's sacrifice, and the one who suffers most has most to give. Wise and insightful words, written by a woman named Lilias Trotter, who was both a missionary and an artist. There are few people in our culture today who would see as clearly as an artist. And of course, today we have all sorts of different types of artists, and our world has become very, very visual. In fact, John Ruskin, he was a famous art critic from the 1800s. He suggested that we do not look in order to paint, but rather art becomes a means of seeing so that we might understand. And so this morning, we're going to examine what it means more clearly. And I thought that it might help us to examine this idea of seeing more clearly if we took a little snippet out of the life of Lilias Trotter. I'm not sure if you've ever heard her before, so let me give you a little bit of background. Lilias was born into a privileged English family, 1853. She was well-educated and had opportunity to travel. She was also a Christian. And do I actually have a picture of Lilias Trotter there? In her 20s, she attended Deeper Life conferences where she committed herself to knowing Jesus and to becoming involved in mission. She volunteered in the very early stages as the YWCA was just beginning to emerge. She did some of the administrative work to get it started. But then she also did very practical ministry, reaching out to the London girls who were working in the London area. And she had a ministry specifically to the prostitutes who hung around Victoria Station. But art was her other passion. John Ruskin, who originally did not believe that women had artistic talent, completely changed his mind, met Lilias Trotter, and said, "I'm beginning to think that only women have true artistic talent." He said she had the potential to become England's greatest living artist. And he took her aside, and he gave her a promise. He said, "I will make you immortal. But there's one catch. You have to devote your whole life to developing this ability, this gift of art that you have been given." She was tempted. And she spent days agonizing, but after discerning, she turned down his offer. And she wrote these words: "I see as clear as daylight now. I cannot give myself to painting in the way Ruskin means and continue to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Loving God and loving people," she decided, "must be the first priority." When she surrendered herself and her art to God, she experienced freedom. And she described this as the liberty of those who have nothing to lose because they have nothing left to keep. and thus she pulled back a little bit from her art and she threw herself more fully into her London ministry. And she continued to go to conferences and learn about mission. And in time, she discovered that there were people in parts of North Africa who'd never even heard the name of Jesus Christ. And at the age of 35, she applied with a missions group. They said, no, we won't take you. Your health isn't strong enough. So she, along with two other female friends who had also been denied, took their own money and got on a boat and headed to Algiers. For the next 40 years, she served the Islamic communities along the north part of Africa. She went along the north coast and down into the Sahara Desert. She put her efforts into building relationships and spending time with her Bible and many hours in prayer, especially in those times when she wasn't well. By the time she died in 1928, she and her colleagues had established 12 mission stations and trained approximately 30 workers to continue reaching North Africa. Throughout her ministry, Lilias kept journals, wrote devotionals, and she continued to paint. And according to her biographer, she pioneered means, methods, and materials that were 100 years before their time. Most people today have never heard the name of Lilias Trotter, although there is now a movie about her life called Many Beautiful Things. She never became the master artist, and some people would say she never really lived up to her potential. But throughout her life, she continued to see the world through the eye of the artist and also the eye of faith. And in her introduction to her book, Between the Desert and the Sea, which was really her love story of Algeria, Lilias invites the reader to come and look. The color pages and the lines of print are with one and the same intent, to make you see. Lilias was not the first person to recognize that spiritual insight comes when we learn to see. Our Bible passage today reminds us that many years earlier, Jesus had told his followers, come, come and look, come and look at me, come and look at what I'm doing. Let God remove what obstructs your vision, then you will see clearly. Even though our passage today is Matthew 7, verses 1 to 6, let's start a little bit earlier. We're going to go back up a couple of weeks earlier. So what you have on your sheets is just Matthew 1 to 6, but actually on the PowerPoint, we start in Matthew 6, 22. So allow me to back up. And as I read, I've made it a little bit easier because I've bolded some of them for you, but just pay attention to the looking and the seeing that's in the passage. Matthew 6, verse 22. The eye is like a lamp for the body. Suppose your eyes are healthy, then your whole body will be full of light. But suppose your eyes can't see well, then your whole body will be full of darkness. If the light inside you is darkness, then it is very dark. No one can serve two masters at the same time. You will hate one of them and love the other, or you'll be faithful to one and dislike the other. You can't serve God and wealth at the same time. I tell you, do not worry. Don't worry about your life and what you will eat or drink, and don't worry about your body and what you will wear. Isn't there more to life than eating? Aren't there more important things for the body than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They don't plant or gather crops. They don't put away the harvest in storerooms, but your Father who is in heaven feeds them. Aren't you worth much more than they are? Can you add even 1 hour to your life by worrying? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the wildflowers grow? They don't work or make clothing. But here's what I tell you. Not even Solomon in all his royal robes was dressed like one of these flowers. If that is how God dresses the wild grass, won't he dress you even better? Your faith is so small. After all, the grass is here only today. Tomorrow it is thrown into the fire, so don't worry. Don't say, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear? People who are ungodly run after all those things. Your Father who is in heaven knows that you need them. But seek God's kingdom first. Do what he wants you to do. Then all those things will also be given to you. So don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. And then this is today's passage. Do not judge other people. Then you will not be judged. You will be judged in the same way you judge others. You will be measured in the same way you measure others. You look at the bit of sawdust in your friend's eye, but you pay no attention to the piece of wood in your own eye. How can you say to your friend, let me take that bit of sawdust out of your eye? How can you say this? Well, there's a log in your own eye. You pretender. First take the piece of wood out of your own eye. Then you will be able to see clearly to take the bit of sawdust out of your friend's eye. Do not give holy things to dogs. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they might walk all over them. They might turn around and tear you to pieces. I was teasing Paul that he purposely gave me this passage because it's a little bit strange. But let's walk through and see if we can unpack it just a bit. So you'll have noticed that Matthew 6:22, where we started, talked about the eyes. It makes sense if we're going to be talking about seeing that the eyes are going to play a part. Eyes, light, health, and sight. Our eyes help us to see accurately what's good. And there's a problem, Jesus says, when our eyes don't see well. But when our eyes are healthy and when there's light in the room, then we can see clearly. This principle works in the physical realm, but there's a spiritual reality as well. Our eyes give away what we're thinking and feeling. We cannot look at two things at once. We cannot follow God and wealth. Jesus asks, are we allowing God to fill our vision so that our lives are oriented to God and God's purposes? Then the passage goes on, and Paul talked about this passage last week, where Jesus tells us that we can learn by looking. He says to the crowds, look at the birds, and be reminded that God takes care of their needs. Then Jesus tells the crowds, see, in order to consider how the wildflowers grow, because God tends them. Jesus encourages us, stop and look and see. Why? So that our little faith might grow stronger. Then Jesus talks about seeking God's kingdom. That word seek means to look carefully in order to find. Jesus said, God's kingdom is here, so I invite you to stop. Look carefully. See what the kingdom is like, and it will have repercussions. You'll begin to experience peace and hope as a result of what you see and understand. And so now we come to Matthew 7. It sounds a bit bizarre. There's a comic, a cartoon there. This passage is a bit bizarre with its discussion about logs and specks in our eyes. But once again, there's this interaction of physical and spiritual sight. The purpose of the discussion is found in verse 5. Then you will see clearly. As we learn to follow Jesus' direction, we'll see clearly. And the reason that we're to see clearly is so that we can learn discernment and wisdom. So the passage expresses two ideas that we're going to explore a little bit. The first idea is do not condemn, but show mercy. And the second idea is do not push, but be wise. So let's look at the first one. Let's look at do not condemn, but show mercy. So if we're to see clearly, we do not condemn, but we show mercy. Those are the blanks that are there. Jesus states, do not judge other people, then you will not be judged. You'll be judged in the same way you judge others. You will be measured in the same way that you measure others. When you start to look at the commentaries, what they say is that Jesus almost takes a pause here. He takes a pause and he thinks back over the main themes of the last couple of chapters of the Sermon on the Mount. And one of the main themes that has been there has been the theme of mercy. We've seen it in verses like, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Jesus has told us to be aware of our tendency to act on anger, to seek revenge, to murder, but instead to show mercy. He's told us to pray, forgive us our debts, forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. So mercy has been coming to the forefront again and again and again as Jesus has been talking to these curious onlookers on the hill. So what he does here is he says it's still about mercy, but let's look at it in the negative. Let's be a little bit more forceful with this idea. If I haven't been able to encourage you by mercy, let's stop and say, let's be aware of judgment. We can only show mercy when we do not judge, when we do not condemn. Only God is the one with the authority to make the decision regarding a person's final destiny, Jesus says. So God can judge, but we must not. Our first reaction might be, but we're Canadians. Hey, we're the people who are tolerant. We don't judge. We're always going around saying that we're sorry. But right, we're laughing. Yeah, on the outside, we can be tolerant. But inside, we can do an awful lot of condemning. Our other reaction might be, but aren't followers of Jesus supposed to fight for justice? We're supposed to live righteously and struggle and making sure that justice happens. I think what Jesus is pointing out here is that seeking justice and working for justice is different than being a dispenser of justice. In one of the commentaries, Bruner argues, the disciples' role is the modest and seemingly less effective one of doing everything for justice up to but excluding its actual leveling. Bruner says, yes, let's work for justice, but at some point we have to say, God has to act. We aren't responsible for that final implementation. There's another reason why Jesus tells us not to judge. You will be measured in the same way that you measure others. So what does he mean by that? There's nothing quite as contagious as a judgmental attitude. As soon as we start condemning others, other people quickly join in. Have you ever noticed that? Someone will say something, you know, a few things positive about an event, and then somebody says, yeah, but this happened. And suddenly that just releases the floodgate. Then everyone else can say what they didn't like about the event and how it didn't live up to the standards that they had anticipated for us. What happens is then people will easily condemn us as well. So when judgmental conversation begins, it becomes very hard to control. Jesus continues with an illustration to show us what judgment looks like. And he says, you look at the bit of sawdust in your friend's eye, a brother's eye, a sister's eye, but you pay no attention to the wood that's in your own eye. We tend to make conclusions that are in our favor. We tear others down. Why? So that we can build ourselves up. And so we judge to defend ourselves. Our perception of ourselves and our situation, though, is not quite accurate. How do we know that? Because we've got a log in our eye. What does a log do? A log cuts off our vision. We can't perceive correctly or accurately if a log is there. Let me provide an example of judgment that's currently out there in our culture. Concerning poor people, over the last few weeks, we've talked quite a bit about giving and poor people and our response. Imagine yourself, you're passing along someone on the street. And you may not say this yourself, but what comes to the forefront is a judgment. Poor people cannot handle money. After all, if this guy knew how to handle money, he wouldn't be poor, would he? Therefore, we decide not to give any money, and we set up all sorts of bureaucracy and forms and hoops to make sure that any money that is given would be spent correctly. Why do we do this? It's because we made a judgment, and we may not even recognize that we made it. We believe that the poor are lazy and untrustworthy. That's the assumption. So then that's what we act upon. But what if that judgment actually isn't valid? What if that judgment is a log in the eye of society? There's a good reason for us to question a judgment like that. And I can just give you a little bit of an example. In the 1970s, the Canadian government conducted a social experiment. Everyone in the town of Dauphin, Manitoba was guaranteed a basic income. 30% of the town, that meant about 1,000 families, received a check in the mail each month. It was guaranteed that they would reach a certain basic income, and they could choose to spend that money however they wanted to spend it. They were not going to be dictated. They just had to agree to allow researchers then to come and interview them. The plan was that this program was going to go for several years. We were going to research it. And then this program was going to be tweaked, and it was going to be implemented all across the country of Canada. What happened? We had a shift in 1979 in the federal government. The program was dropped. The data was never processed. It was simply stored away and ignored. Then in 2009, a university professor who'd actually been in university in the 70s and had heard about this program and been intrigued, had been searching and searching and searching, and finally she found that they had been tucked away in an archive. She found the data and she began to analyze it. She said the program was a resounding success. She said the concern is that if you give poor people money, they'll just stop working. And she said that's not what happened at all. She said a few of them worked a little less because they started to go to school. They stayed in school longer. Their marks improved. Domestic violence was down. Mental health complaints lessened. And hospitalizations decreased 8.5%. Even years later, that whole town was healthier than the other towns around it. So what does this show us? Time and time and time again, our assumptions and our judgments are inaccurate. That gives us reason to pause. The provincial government, the new government, when it came in last year, promised that it would continue a basic income program that was being implemented. But next month, at the end of March, 4,000 people, Hamilton, Thunder Bay, will receive their last check. They had already made decisions based on getting that money. We have no idea of the stress that that's going to cause in the lives of those families. And I suspect that our health system will probably pay a greater cost than what it would have cost to have kept the program in place. And I wonder if our unexamined judgments about poor people actually played a part in causing the end of this project. How accurately are we seeing the situations around us? Are we just looking at the moment, or are we looking at the long-term implications of the judgments that we make? Here's another way that we judge: body shaming. It tends to be more women, but I've noticed young men as well are also dealing with this as well. We humiliate others and ourselves by making critical comments about body shape and body size. We adopt a certain image of a body ideal because that's the image that's promoted as ideal in the media. In fact, only a small percentage of the population, somewhere between 5 and 10%, actually fit or can fit into that ideal. But we judge anyone who looks different. We criticize ourselves and we end up feeling miserable. We look and we see, but our perspectives are limited. And we forget about the gracious way that God looks at us and sees and accepts us just the way we are. So I want you to pause for a moment. And I want you to think over this last week. And I want you to think about, how have you judged? When you heard something on the media, how did you judge it? When you were sitting on the GO train, was there someone that came on and you just immediately judged them? Perhaps something a school teacher said, or a classmate, a parent, an older person, a younger person. How have you judged someone this week? There are so many different ways that we can judge. The color of our skin, where we live, how we dress, how we spend our money, a word that is used. We condemn other countries, we condemn our neighbors, we condemn our family members, we condemn ourselves, and the list goes on and on and on. And there are implications of this. As a result of our condemnations, our family relationships can easily become broken or strained. We sit back in judgment rather than participating in the political process of bringing forth change. It's easier to listen to people making fun of current political parties or events. But when we judge, what we tend to do is we tend to become passive. And Jesus is saying, maybe there's something more than passivity. The relationships we share in the church congregations are also implicated in this. They never deepen. In my role as a seminary professor, I get the opportunity to talk to a lot of different students on a regular basis about what's happening in their congregations. And currently, one of the conversations is, how are people going to be formed? How do people change? How do we get some depth? How will we get any depth if we spend our time condemning one another? How can we be honest if admitting our mistakes and our vulnerability will simply lead to further condemnation or judgment? How can we admit our mistakes and vulnerabilities if we can't even see them ourselves? Now, Jesus doesn't mean that those judgments aren't valid. After all, the friend, the brother, or the sister actually does have some sawdust or have a little piece of dirt in their eyes. And so we can't just ignore the problem. So here we are, we're told not to condemn because it's going to lend to this condemning attitude, but we can't just ignore it either. So we feel somewhat caught. What do we do? Well, fortunately, once again, when we look at this passage in light of what's come before, we discover that Jesus actually gives us several very practical suggestions. He suggested that the change requires gaining ability to see. And first of all, it means one, embracing God's grace. Remember that God is the judge, but God is the gracious judge. So yes, God is the one who will judge, and God is the one who has the authority to judge, but God is also the one who chooses to act toward us in mercy and in grace. So where do we start? We start with a prayer. God, here is my tendency to judge others. Thank you that in Jesus Christ I have received grace. May I learn to receive your grace and respond in grace rather than in judgment. In a lot of ways, we're saying, Jesus, save me from myself. Second, walk in humility. Once again, pray. Ask God to help you to see the log in your own eye. Now, we want to see the log not so that we wallow in self-pity, not so that we go around feeling woe is me and harsh with ourselves, and we're simply judging ourselves. But the purpose of seeing our log is to acknowledge dependency, vulnerability, and teachability. So I'm going to say that again. So when we see our own log, we are acknowledging dependency. We need others. We don't have the full picture. So I need your perspective. Vulnerability. I have a log. I know I'm not perfect. I know I'm making mistakes. And teachability. Therefore, show me your perspective that I might grow and that I might learn. We need each other. And the best way to see that need is to be aware that I might have a log. It's obvious to everyone else, but I can't see it. But as a result, my perception is being narrowed, and I need someone else to come along and say, hey, open up your perspective a little bit. Look at it from my experience and from how I have learned. And then the third is to recognize the complexity. Judgment is often the result of labels. We simplify a situation, we label it, or we label her or him, and then we can condemn. But instead, as we seek to see better, let's learn to ask questions. Let's learn to discover that there's stories behind the situations. Let's gather information and define terms, not to condemn, but so that we can become more aware. The situation is more complicated than we imagined, and as a result, we're going to need all sorts of perspectives so that we can tackle and solve the problem together. So if we take those things and put them into practice, if we embrace God's grace, walk in humility, and recognize the complexity, how are we going to know if we're changing? How are we going to know if as a congregation we're changing? We'll notice it in our language, because we'll start to say things like, oh, thank you for making me aware of that. Or, oh, I'm seeing something that I never even imagined before. Or, now I'm starting to understand. God can help us see more clearly, because God is the one who sees. And once we see ourselves in light of God's mercy, once our logs are removed or at least acknowledged, then we can help others with their specks or their bits of sawdust. And other people want help. Help is valued. Bits of dust and bits of sawdust, they hurt. And as Henry Nouwen reminds us, it's the wounded healer who can reach out and help others who are wounded. We can see better. The arrogant, judgmental attitude is left behind. I've had a couple situations in classrooms where I've had students, seminary students sometimes, you know, they're firm in a position and they want to argue with one another. And sometimes I've had a student say, hey, you know what? When you come across as arrogant, I can't hear what your idea is. And if we can leave those attitudes behind, we can say, okay, this is where I'm standing now, but I'm open to input and change. Mercy and grace emerge out of our self-critical reflection, but also at a deeper examination of the character of God. And then, just when we think we've kind of got things figured out, Jesus goes on and starts talking about dogs and pigs. What does he mean? Here, Jesus is encouraging us, don't push, but be wise. Just because we're going to stop condemning doesn't mean that we need to stop thinking. We're still supposed to think, we're still invited to discern, we're still invited to make wise choices. And so then Jesus gives us this visual example of pigs and dogs, because I suspect the people that were listening would remember it, to suddenly have this visual image. Now, we also need to remember what was happening in Jesus' day. In Jesus' day, dogs were not pets the way that they are today. In Jesus' day, dogs were strays in the streets. They would steal food and they would cause trouble, especially if they started to run in a pack. They could be quite dangerous. Pigs. Pigs were unclean animals. Jewish families would certainly not keep pigs, and in many cases, they wouldn't even want to touch a pig. No one would ever consider giving a pearl to a pig? Pearls are beautiful. Pearls are rare. Pearls are valuable. Pearls are expensive. But it's a kind of a funny image to imagine a pig with a string of pearls around its neck. But an untouchable animal certainly would never be given anything valuable and expensive. Pigs simply don't need pearls. So what was Jesus trying to communicate? Bruner suggests that Jesus is telling us that we need to be really wise as we start to share this good news with others. As we begin to experience freedom and lack of condemning, we want to share the good news. And Bruner's saying, being aware that our culture, the people around us, might not be so quick to make the shift. So he says, pay attention to how receptive people are. How are people responding to the news that you're giving? He says, don't arrogantly push your faith on others if they're not ready to receive, because they'll see it as arrogant condemnation instead of the good news of the freedom of the gospel. Dallas Willard, in his book Divine Conspiracy, he suggests that Jesus tells us we need to be more discerning so that we give people what they actually need. He suggests that dogs simply don't need holy things, and people and pigs just don't need pearls. What do dogs need? Dogs need discipline so that they don't start attacking. Pigs need food. And if we give them what they don't need, they'll become dangerous. So if we're wise, we'll give people what they need. And in time, hopefully, they'll become receptive to the good news of the gospel. And this receptivity is more likely if we truly see them the way that they are. If we go in grace, if we walk in humility. Another thing I think we might want to do is we might want to evaluate the tools by which we measure success in Christian ministry and in the church. If we measure success by numbers, then numbers of converts or numbers of people in the pew, we're going to be tempted to start to push people to gather numbers, fudge the numbers, make them up. That would be the equivalent of giving holy items to dogs and pearls to pigs. So Jesus asks us to reflect upon the situation, think deeply, see clearly, discern what's needed, and then provide generously. Fortunately, we don't have to figure out on our own, because in the next paragraph that Paul's going to discuss next week, we're invited to come, ask, and seek, and knock. So how do we learn to see? How do we learn to discern? How do we learn to become wise? And there's two questions, and terribly profound questions, but super easy questions. And the first question is why? As we move away from condemnation and develop wisdom, why will be the most helpful question we begin to ask? So when we see a homeless person, rather than assume or condemn, ask why. And then ask why again. Why is this person here? What's the story that brought him here? When the government cancels a program, ask why. What's the real reason behind it? And should I take action? When a son or a daughter wants to do something that seems absolutely crazy to you, don't condemn. Ask why. Kids, when you say something and a parent seems to totally overreact, don't condemn. Ask why. When your neighbor makes a strange purpose that ticks you off, take a step back. Don't condemn. Ask why. When someone at church reacts in an unexpected way or interprets a passage that makes absolutely no sense to you, ask why. Because asking why helps to remove the log better than anything else does and enables us to see that complexity and bring forth clarity. And the second question is related but a little bit different. It's how. How can I live into grace? How can I show mercy and help with what is really needed? How can I live in God's love toward others? Once we've clarified the issue, then we can help remove that speck of dust. It's once we see and understand that we can suggest together what's most appropriate. And then, as I do with any passage, I encourage us, let's just take a step back and take a final look. What does this passage tell me about God's character? What is God really like? This passage reminds us that while God could condemn us, God has chosen to offer us life through grace as we follow Jesus Christ. What does God see when God looks at us? God sees a world of goodness and brokenness that one day he will make completely new in Jesus Christ. What does God's character and perspective provide for us this morning? Hope. There's freedom from judgment and the possibility that we can learn to see from God's perspective. Lilias Trotter didn't give up her arts. However, she took a bit of a career switch. She wanted to pursue the vision with which God had entrusted her. In her Parables of the Cross, she wrote of spiritual lessons she understood by looking closely at the plants that were around her, and she speaks of the dandelion that you see in the picture. She says, what marks the dandelion? Detachment. It stands ready for God's wind to blow the seed. And it's not responsible for where those seeds land and take fruit. It's simply responsible to say, God, you can have what I am, who I am, and what I have, and take it and use it where you want to use it. And so Lilias Trotter today invites us not to cling to our judgments, not to have confidence in our own resources, but to invite God's Spirit to help us as we learn to live into God's kingdom with its upside down values. And so she reminds us, measure your life by loss and not by gain. Not by the wine drunk, but by the wine poured forth, for love's strength stand and love's sacrifice. And the one who suffers most has most to give. Our culture tells us to keep, to count, to hoard, to serve ourselves, and to condemn those around us who simply do not live up to the rules that we have established for them. But Jesus invites us to come, to look, to experience freedom from condemnation. Jesus invites us to trust in his mercy and his resources that we might gain wisdom, because Jesus is the one who suffered most so that he might give us life. And as we invite God's Spirit to shape us, we can learn to give willingly, generously, and freely. Why can we walk away from condemnation? Because through the Spirit of God, we can finally learn to see and see with clarity. Let's pray.